Well, hello, good morning. It's Sunday morning. It's 11:05. I'm Terry Bennett and it's Folk Tales. And in the studio today, my guest is Simon Lowell. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Terry.
Simon, it's fair to say you're a musician.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I'm a musician. I'm a classically trained musician. But these days I have my finger in all sorts of different pies. I live near here, near Sherborne, but I play the organ down in Swanage at the parish church there, St Mary's Parish Church. And then I have a very busy freelance career. I work a lot for the BBC in their religious department, playing the organ directing on programmes like Daily Service, Morning Worship on Sunday. And I'm one of the regular conductors for Songs of Praise. I do a lot of arranging for Decca, for artists like Russell Watson, Ali Jones, things like that. So, you know, very varied. And then I keep up my directing, choral directing, which I do. I'm just about to go off to New Mexico and off to South Africa. So there's never a dull moment, really.
Well, it sounds a very exciting life. And you were once organist of Salisbury Cathedral, I believe.
I was. My dream job since I was a little boy, I wanted to be the organist of Salisbury Cathedral. And somebody smiled on me and I had that marvellous privilege for almost 10 years, which was fantastic.
Excellent. We will talk a lot about your life presently, but let's take your first piece. Now, this is the St. Matthew Passion by Bach. Just tell us a little bit about why you've chosen this.
Well, this piece is very special to me. For me, Bach is just a most fantastic composer, heaven sent, really. And I was a chorister at St. Paul's in London, and each Passion Tide, just before Easter, we used to do the St. Matthew Passion in the cathedral. And it's the story of the whole Easter story, really, set to music in arias and choruses and recitative. And it was something that really moved me. And I remember particularly the opening of it, the wonderful instrumental opening, and then the chorus comes in. And then on top of the chorus, Bach puts a chorale tune, which the choristers used to sing, what's called the ripieno. And to this day, when I hear that moment, I get a tingle down my spine. It's just so magical. So this piece, for me, probably my favourite ever choral piece.
Thank you. Well, the opening of J.S. Bach's St. Matthew Passion, played there by the Consorticum Musicum, chosen by Simon Lowell, my guest in the studio this morning. Great start, Simon. Really powerful music, isn't it?
Isn't that just wonderful? I mean, it just makes you feel so good. It's just, words fail me, really. It's just genius.
Let's go back and talk about your early life. You're not Dorset born and bred, are you?
No. You can tell from my accent. I'm a Londoner. I was born in Hammersmith and grew up as a very young boy in Chiswick. I'm that old that I can still remember trolley buses. And then we spent a little bit of time in the home counties. And then back in the 1960s, my dad, with his job, moved down to Bristol. And so we all up sticks and went down to Bristol and settled there. And my parents still live there to this day.
And what was your father's profession?
He worked in advertising, actually. Okay. And I never quite knew what he did, but that's what he told me anyway.
And you have some brothers, I believe.
Yeah, I've got three brothers. I'm the eldest of four, not the most responsible, but the eldest of four. And in fact, two of my brothers. One of my brothers is a head teacher and an Ofsted inspector, so I'm a bit scared of him. And my other two brothers both went into music like I did. And whereas I went into cathedral music, one of my brothers went into opera as a conductor. And another one played for a while in West End shows as a bass player.
And, okay, so there's a musical tradition, but parents weren't particularly musical, I believe.
No, not at all. My parents weren't in the slightest musical, but I do have... My uncle was a singer. He was a choral scholar at King's College, Cambridge, and great friend of David Wilcox. And his two sons, my cousins, were both choristers at Westminster Abbey and are both now professional musicians. So... It was sort of in the family, but not directly in my line. So, it just was one of those things that I loved.
So a lot of your early years there in and around Bristol, mm-hmm. Was that an enjoyable childhood living there?
Yeah, well, I remember. I mean, I'm still very fond of Bristol now. My father is still alive and lives in Bristol, so I go quite often to see him. And, I'm very fond of Bristol. I have happy memories both at primary school, and then I liked singing, and I joined the choir of St Mary Redcliffe, where I only stayed there for about 6 months or so, but I really loved it. It was great. I mean, it's a wonderful building and sort of like a cathedral, really.
What age would you have been then?
Oh, gosh. I think I was about seven or seven and a half, eight, something like that. You know, and that was my first foray into this whole world, magical world of church music. And I just remember it just being so thrilling. And of course, St. Mary Redcliffe is the proud possessor of one of the finest organs, English organs in the country, the Harrison and Harrison organ. And the organist at the time, Garth Benson, who was a very kind man, a bit scary, but a kind man, and used to sit in the pit where the organ console is, and we used to watch after evensong and after the morning services he played. Wonderful player. And it was just amazingly thrilling.
But you didn't remain there all that long, as you say, because the big city called again.
The big city called, yeah. And I look back, having spent a lot of time myself directing parish church choirs in my early career, if you ever got a young kid who was a good singer, you'd want to hang on to them. But I don't suggest that I was a brilliant singer, but I was good. And Garth Benson recognised that I had something to offer. And rather than keep me, he said to my dad that I ought to go to a cathedral because a cathedral would stretch me further. And so I ended up, very fortunately, at St. Paul's Cathedral in London as a chorister. And I had five. I still say now, actually, probably the five of the happiest years of my whole life.
How did that actually work then? You don't just rock up at St. Paul's and say, "Hi, can I sing in your choir?"
sort of a bit like that. No. I mean, I didn't get in through the back door, but Garth Benson at St Mary Redcliffe had been a chorister at St Paul's himself. And the organist at the time was a revered and eminent gentleman called Sir John Dykes Bower, known to everybody as DB. And he was coming towards the end of his career, but Garth Benson had been one of his choristers during the Second World War. So you see how far back we're going. Anyway, Garth rang DB up and said, "I've got this lad in Bristol. I'd like you to hear him." So he prepared me. I learnt a hymn and I learnt a little piece. And I went up to London and met the great John Dykes-Bauer, and he auditioned me, not in an ordinary voice trial. It was just me and him. And then we got a phone call to say that he'd like to take me on. I laugh about it now, actually, because this man had been the organist at St. Paul's for, 30, 40 years, something ridiculous like that. And I was the last chorister that he appointed. And I often laugh now and say that probably he realised his judgment was now flawed and he appointed me and then he quit.
So off you went to London then. Was that a bit of an upheaval? I imagine it probably was at that age.
Huge upheaval, really. I mean, even before the M4 was built. Well, that makes me sound like a dinosaur, doesn't it? And I remember my first term lasted, I can remember vividly, 22nd of April, and it lasted until the end of July. And in those days, you know, it was not easy for my mum and dad to get up to London. So I think in that first term, I saw my parents twice, maybe, in all that time. But I was so mesmerised by all the music, the cathedral, you know, everything that was going on was so amazing that I soon sort of settled into it. There were only 38 boys in the school. You know, the choristers were the school. So I had the most amazing education. And although I got a bit homesick once or twice, it actually suited me and I became very independent and there was a lot of sport going on as well. So it was brilliant. I absolutely loved it.
And they keep you pretty busy, don't they, in the choir?
I mean, it was crazy. I mean, we used to do, I mean, matins on some days and sing every day bar Thursday. So I think we were singing about 14 services a week, 2 rehearsals a day. We had instrumental practice morning and evening. I think in a day when we were at choir school, we perhaps had half an hour to ourselves. You know, everything else was timetabled, which was, you know, you either went with it or you didn't, but you had to. I mean, on reflection, I remember that when I left at the end of that whole period, I actually found it quite hard to manage my own time, you know, and suddenly I had all this free time at my secondary school because I was so used to just being told what to do every second of every day. But it suited me and I loved it, working hard.
And that was the time when your initial interest in the organ started to come out, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, obviously St. Paul's has got the most fantastic Philo Willis organ. And you'd hear it being played every day. And in those days, the organ console used to be in the north choir case, as you're looking at the high altar, it'd be on the left-hand side. And so you had to go up a sort of some creaky steps up to where the organist was playing, and it was sort of like in a box, really, and you could hear all the hissing because there was a lot of wind leaks. And I mean, it was the pneumatic action and really thrilling. So we used to go, two of us used to go up and turn the pages after Evensong quite often, and that was really thrilling to watch, you know, because we were watching some of the best. And, you know, I think I thought, well, I'd like to do that too.
Were you able to actually start playing at that point, or did that come later?
Well, I didn't. I mean, one or two of my contemporaries did, but I didn't. But when I went back to Bristol and went to my secondary school, I started to learn the organ pretty soon after that.
All right. You stayed at St. Paul's for 5 years, you say. So you were, what, 13 when you came away from there. And back to Bristol.
Back to Bristol to Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which is the Blue Coat School in Bristol, where I did my O-levels and my A-levels. And loads of music there, great music department, very good teachers. And I owe them a lot, really. And, you know, they fostered my interest in the organ, my interest in singing, and got me through an A-level music too.
Traditionally, learning the organ, you start with the piano. Was that your route into it?
Because at St. Paul's, I had piano lessons with a very ferocious lady who used to rap us over the knuckles with a ruler if we hadn't practiced our scales. I can still play F sharp minor pretty well because of her viciousness. So I was a pretty proficient, you know, I was sort of grade 7, grade 8, age 13. So it was a natural progression onto the organ afterwards.
Okay. But that signalled the end of your singing career because presumably you came a lot deeper, did you?
Yeah, well, not straight away. And in fact, when I first left, I still had my singing voice. And I'd been very fortunate that I actually became head chorister of St. Paul's for a year, which is a great privilege. And so when I went to my secondary school, obviously the director of music thought, oh, we've got this chorister from St. Paul's, we need to use him. But I was absolutely adamant that that was it. I'd hung up my vocal cords or whatever the analogy is. And so I didn't sing after that until I, you know, a couple of years later when I became a tenor bass. And I think one of my only regrets in my career, musical career, is that I didn't have a great voice after that. I used to love singing, and I almost would have swapped everything I've done since to being a professional singer, because I love it.
Doesn't necessarily follow, does it?
But, No, not at all.
One great example, of course, you mentioned Aled Jones, and I know he's a friend of yours.
There you go, he's a great friend of mine. And yeah, I mean, Aled was one of the best trebles I ever heard. And he sings a very lovely sort of second tenor baritone now, but he himself would admit that, you know, he doesn't have the star quality of voice today that he had when he was a kid. But I mean, he was amazingly special, so there's a huge amount of pressure. And, you know, for me, yeah, I made quite a nice noise and I can sight read stuff and I can, you know, I can add to a choir, but you're never going to see my name in lights.
So very immersed in music still when you're back in Bristol. What about academics?
I had a very good education, early education at choir school. We were learning Latin and Greek when I was sort of 9 and 10. And I was reasonably bright, but I have to say, and I look back now, that I was a bit lazy. And I did very, very well academically at choir school. Everything suited me. But when I went, as I just alluded to, when I went to my secondary school, first of all, time management was not one of my strong points. And also, I think I was quite lazy. And therefore, I sort of thought, I took it all in my stride and I thought, I can do all this. But actually, I suddenly realised that it still needed some hard work, and I didn't do that to start with. And I think in my I did some mock O levels, and I failed one of them, and that was such a kick up the backside because I thought, oh my gosh, you know. So then after that, I worked harder. So I don't think I ever academically fulfilled my full potential. Let's put it that way.
Let's have your second record. This is the Elgar Cello Concerto.
Edward Elgar is another of my absolute favourite composers. A very difficult composer to perform, wonderful to listen to, very difficult to perform really well. You know, there's so many nuances in Elgarian music. But the violin concerto and the cello concerto, which we're going to listen to a bit of now, for me, just encapsulated everything that man did. So special. And even to this day, all those years later, Jacqueline Dupré's recording of it, for me, still is the absolute peak. And I worked for a number of years in Warwick at the Collegiate Church of St. Mary as the director of music. And while I was at Warwick, I used to go across to the Malvern Hills and I used to take my headphones and I used to sit on the top of the Malvern Hills where Elgar used to walk and get his inspiration. And I used to listen to the cello concerto and I was in heaven.
Well, Simon and I were just sat here enjoying that. I think we could have played the remaining 5 minutes of that quite easily.
Absolutely.
It's a splendid piece, isn't it? And no better version than the Jacqueline Dupré one, which we just heard there. The Adagio Moderato from Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor, Opus 85. Jacqueline Dupré with the LSO under the direction of course, Sir John Barbaroli. Simon, we got to the point where you were about to leave school in Bristol, I think. You were doing O-levels and A-levels.
Yeah.
What was your thinking at that time about your career direction? Was it going to be music? Had you made that decision?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Partly because I think it was anything I could do, really. I was not going to be a centre forward for Man United or Arsenal, I should say, which is my great other passion in life. yeah, I mean, music is my great love, and, you know, music flows through my veins. So, yeah, I knew that's what I wanted to do. But I have always been a little bit reticent, or a bit outspoken, actually, is the word, I suppose, about Oxbridge. And for church musicians, the Oxbridge route, organ scholarship, is the sort of natural progression. And I didn't really want to do that. So I went to London instead, and I got a place at King's College at London University to read the BMAS course. And I was fortunate enough at the same time to get a place at the Guildhall School of Music to learn my keyboard skills. And concurrently with both of those two, I got the organ scholarship at St Paul's Cathedral, going back to where I'd started off. So I had the best of all worlds, really. I had an academic training, I had a music college training, and then I had practical training at a very busy, vibrant cathedral.
The organ scholar at St Paul's Cathedral is a prestigious position.
Yeah.
It's not something they give away to anybody.
No.
That obviously would have been incredibly good training in church musicianship.
Oh, fantastic. And I mean, at the time that I was there, I mean, my duties weren't enormous. You know, I played quite a lot of pieces before big services and voluntaries, accompanied the choir from time to time, but not hugely. But sort of just watching was something which, you know, you can learn so much from the experience of being subsumed by the music around you and just by the experts who are doing it. So just to sit and turn pages while Christopher Dernley, who was the director of music, played the organ. And I was there at the time when the great Barry Rose was in charge of the choir. Barry, who's become a great friend of mine since. And it was just amazing just to watch and to listen. And a very young John Scott was the number three organist as well. So, you know, amazing times, and very lucky to be there then.
And being one of the major cathedrals of London, I guess you had a fair share of quite notable occasions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there were lots of royal occasions. I mean, I remember as a chorister, the Queen used to come quite regularly. And as organ scholar, you know, I had the chance to play for a few sort of royal occasions, which was very nerve-wracking, but very good for me, really, and a great, you know, a great leveller.
And in the background, you were doing academic studies in music,
mm-hmm.
Which presumably after 3 years gave you
gave me a degree and, you know, a hood to wear.
Yes.
I fancied doing that.
That's all very nice, but you've still got to find gainful employment, haven't you? So what happened next?
Well, then, church music was my thing. Since I was a little boy, a chorister at St Paul's, I wanted to be the organist of Salisbury Cathedral. I didn't want to be a fireman or an astronaut. It was to be organist of Salisbury Cathedral, because my choir master at St Paul's, for most of the time, Christopher Dernley, had come from Salisbury, and he used to tell me about it. But, I mean, that was a pipe dream, you know. I never, ever thought I'd do that. So, I remember going to the registrar at the Guildhall and when I was going to be finishing, and said, are there any church jobs around London? And the only prerequisite that I was looking for was one that had a flat going with it, because, you know, if I could find somewhere to live, then I could. So they said to me, yeah, there's a job going in Barking in East London, at the parish church in Barking, and doesn't pay very much, but there's a flat, free flat goes with it. So I applied and I got the job. I would make you laugh if I told you I was the only candidate, but I got the job. And I spent 2 years embarking, which was an education for me in many ways, both as a musician and as a person.
You were clearly a very accomplished organist at that point, but what about directing the choir? Is that something you get trained for in
No. I mean, that's something nowadays I look back and I feel very strongly about that, that directing choirs is about, the skill is about managing people, inspiring people. In later life, I think it was the great Barry Rose that said to me, directing a choir is like looking in the mirror. And when you think of that analogy, it's an amazing one, really, because I remember when I was at Salisbury, for example, when we had daily boys' practice or girl chorister practice, if I was in a bit of a bad mood, the kids would sing in that sort of slightly more aggressive way. If I was really happy, they'd be bright and sparky. You know, your choir reflects you. You have to inspire your choir all the time. And the one thing that barking did for me, because it was an interesting group of people, there was about 50 people in the choir, age ranging from a little old lady who was about 95 through to sort of a few kids who were 6 and 7. So I had to deal with every type of person, and grumpy people, happy people, angry people, oh, everything. And it taught me a huge lesson on how to get on and train people. So that was a good start.
But barking was never going to be your long-term home. So you
no, it was
you
good.
Moved on.
I think back and it was fun, you know, but yeah, no, it wasn't. So I only stayed there for 2 years, and then I applied to be the organist and choir master at Croydon Parish Church, which had a very good reputation. It had been the place where the Royal School of Church Music was based at the time, at Addington Palace, and various wardens of Addington had been the organists of Croydon Parish Church, Dr. Roy Massey, Michael Fleming, some very notable names. And I was fortunate to get that job, and lovely four-manual Hill organ. And I spent 5 years there, and they were good years, and I did some more work at St. Paul's at the same time, and in fact I also had a city church. I got a job at one of the city churches. So I was sort of immersed in music making, and Croydon was good for me. I made lots of mistakes, but, you know, it was great, and I really enjoyed it.
That further develops your musicianship and abilities with the choir.
Yeah, and my abilities with the choir. We had a very fine girls' choir, which I didn't run. Somebody else ran that. And I sort of recruited the boys, and we used to drive around South London collecting the boys each time there was a practice. It was quite tough, you know, but these days at Croydon Parish Church, it's called Croydon Minster, and it's been elevated, and they have an amazing tradition. And in fact, I went back there a couple of years ago when they were restoring the organ, and I was so impressed with what I saw, and it sort of makes you feel proud to be part of that lineage, if you like.
Being part of a cathedral choir or organ scholar, as you were around St. Paul's, and then moving on to these other positions, it doesn't leave a whole lot of time, a lot of spare time, but were you able to nonetheless enjoy living in London as you were at that time?
Yeah, but I mean, in those days, these parish church jobs didn't pay very much, so you had to, do other things to survive, really. So I did some school teaching. I taught at Whitgift School in Croydon and at an another local prep school. I taught music. And that wasn't really something which I particularly enjoyed, but, you know, it paid the bills, so I had to do that. But I did immerse myself in London and going to services at the Cathedral, the Abbey, Royal Festival Hall, stuff like that. You know, it was great. It was a great time.
Mm. Let's have your third track. I was very much hoping you'd choose a piece of organ music, and I'm not sure whether perhaps you've done so just to please me. Chosen the Jig Fugue by Bach. Tell us about this.
Well, as an organist, again, Bach is just superb, just right at the top of the tree. You know, as an organist, one learns a lot of his works. And the Jig Fugue, I love so much of his music, it's very hard to choose something, but the Jig Fugue is short and pithy and exciting and vibrant. And I've always loved it. I've always really loved it, and it always makes me smile. And I thought it would be rather good to hear a recording, which is quite dear to my heart, from St. Mary Redcliffe that we talked about earlier, and the lovely Edwardian organ there. And an old colleague of mine, Kevin Bowyer, who's a very distinguished organist, with whom I worked at Warwick for a few years, he made a recording of what he termed as Edwardian Bach, probably not the way Bach is often thought of and interpreted, but and Kevin's view was, if you've got a lovely Edwardian English organ, use it. So in this particular performance, there are tubas and all sorts of things, and I just think it's brilliant, and every time I hear it, it makes me feel very happy.
The Jig Fugue by Bach. Glorious stuff, and that was the Jig Fugue by J.S. Bach, Fugue in G Major, to give it its more proper title, BWV 577, and that was Kevin Bowyer at the organ of St. Mary's Redcliffe in Bristol, chosen by Simon Lowell, my guest on Folk Tales today. So, Simon, you were in Croydon, and what happened after that?
I spent 5 years in Croydon and doing various things, and then the job came up as director of music at St. Mary's Collegiate Church in Warwick. And in those days, in the mid-80s, the Warwick Choir was probably the best church choir in the country. I mean, there were 30 boys, 18 men, and I, the incumbent director at the time was Paul Trepty, who's been the very distinguished organist at Ely for the last 30 years or so, just soon to retire. But Paul ran the Warwick Choir at the time, and he moved on to Bury St Edmunds, the cathedral there, before moving on to Ely. And so the job was vacant, so I applied for it. It was a full-time job, not thinking I'd get it because, you know, it was very prestigious. But for whatever reason, they offered it to me, and so I went to Warwick, and I stayed 9 years in Warwick, and most fantastic time. I mean, It was great with the BBC. They used to come and do choral evensong once a year from Warwick, which no other parish church did. And I learned so much at that place working. You know, it was like a cathedral choir, except we only sang at the weekends. And we did lots of trips, American tours. We went to cathedrals every year, you know, as a residency in the summer. It was absolutely amazing, and I loved every second of it, really.
You eventually ended up at Sheffield. Was that directly from Warwick?
Yeah, it was. Mm. I mean, I look back now and I think I probably almost overstayed my welcome at Warwick, and I stayed for too long, and I sort of started to believe my own publicity that I was invincible. But and I did want to go to a cathedral, and I did apply for one or two that I dreamed of. We used to go to Norwich a lot, and when the organist left at Norwich, I so wanted to be organist in Norwich, second only to Salisbury, but it did have a spire, so it was. And I did apply for that and a couple of others, and I got quite close. And in fact, Bristol as well, Bristol Cathedral, I got shortlisted for some of these jobs. So I sort of thought, I'm in with a chance, but I wasn't an Oxbridge candidate. And then the job came up at Sheffield, and I do remember shamefully thinking, gosh, this bit beneath me, really. You know, it wasn't in a particularly good state, but it was the best thing I ever did. It really was. I loved Sheffield Cathedral. I love Sheffield Cathedral to this day. We didn't have a choir school, so I had to go out and do my recruiting. It was very real. That was the thing. I mean, for example, I remember very early on as a football fan, I discovered in those days, both Sheffield Wednesday and Sheffield United, when I first went to the cathedral, were both in the Premier League. And all my boys supported Sheffield Wednesday. And I realised very quickly that if Sheffield Wednesday won on a Saturday, then we'd have a good service on Sunday morning. I'm serious about this. If they didn't win, if they lost, all hell would break loose, and it would be really difficult to sing the next day. So, yeah, that was interesting. But it was fantastic. And we started, I had a girls' choir at Warwick. I started the girls' choir at Warwick about the same time as the Salisbury choir started, ironically. And so that was one of the things that the Provost Dean of Sheffield wanted me to do. And I started a new girls' choir at Sheffield, which became very successful. And we just had access to some amazing, we had about 30 girls, and just amazing girls. And the standard was unbelievable, really. And I was really happy there. And I lived out in the Peak District. Sheffield is an amazing city. I'm a real southerner, but to go up north and experience the grittiness of the north was something that I'll never forget. And I look back now and I regret that I was only there 3 years, but another cathedral with a spire came calling, and so I didn't last.
The higher spire, shall we say, was then calling, wasn't it?
The higher spire, yes. I should say that when I got the job at Sheffield, and all my friends knew that I wanted to be at Salisbury, and I remember people saying, with a slight twinkle in their eyes, saying, well, don't worry, you know, at least you're now the organist of a cathedral beginning with S, with a spire. But yeah, 3 years later, the organist of Salisbury decided to retire. And my dean at the time, who went on to be the dean of Durham, he had been at Salisbury, and he said to me, have you heard that Richard Seale's retiring? And then he said to me, but you mustn't go for the job because we want to keep you here. But you can apply the next time. And I thought, well, blow that for a game of soldiers. You know, he's been organist of Salisbury Cathedral for 30 plus years. If I miss my chance now, I'll never get another chance. So I did bung my name and put my hat in the ring with a lot of very distinguished people. And I look back now and I still can't believe that they chose me, because there are one or two people whose names I won't mention who are on the list with me, who are doing amazing things today. But anyway, they did choose me. And so in 1997, my dream came true. I remember a telephone call from the then dean offering me the job. And after Evensong that day, I went out and bought the biggest bottle of champagne you've ever seen, and I drank it all in one go.
And so at last you were in Salisbury Cathedral. Indeed. This was your dream job. The pinnacle of your career, really.
Totally.
So you'd never had any aspirations to go to St Paul's as director of music or Westminster Abbey or anything like that?
No. Salisbury was the be-all and the end-all of everything to me, and that was the place I wanted to be. And I can't really explain to you what it feels like when you realise your dream.
Did it live up to your expectations?
Yeah, of course it did. And I look back now, and I I've got so many happy memories. But you do realise, you know, life is what it is, and there's a reality about life. And the cathedral choirs, you know, they're made up of people, like orchestras are made up of people. And so there are always frustrations, you know, kids being ill. I mean, there are all sorts of things. And so I suppose what I'm trying to say is that although it completely lived up to my expectations, it wasn't without its own frustrations at time, because it was just about real life.
And it's, I guess, about putting your stamp on it, despite the fact that Richard Seale, as you say, had been there for 30 years, a very distinguished figure in his own right. But had new ideas, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I remember people were very good to me that, you know, Richard Seale was a great hero of mine and the most lovely man. And I remember thinking and saying to people at the time that, gosh, how am I going to follow this legend? I mean, because I use the word advisedly, but he was a legend. He still is, and a hero of mine. And I thought to myself, well, I can't be better than him because he did so much. And he was also the nicest chap you could ever meet. So I thought to myself, and I can't be nicer than him. So the only option I've got left is to be different and put my own stamp on it. So that's what I did. And, you know, and people made it very easy for me to do that. So, you know, I had huge support. So although it was tough following somebody after 30 years, people were ready for a change, and so they gave me the chance, and that was fantastic.
Let's take your fourth record, All Angels and Songbird.
Yeah. I mean, this is a song. This is a song, Songbird. I think I first heard Eva Cassidy sing this, and it's a song that I absolutely adore. But this has a special memory to me, Songbird, because in a later career, post Salisbury Cathedral, when I was sort of thinking, what's next on the menu? Out of the blue, I got a phone call from a record producer from Decca Records, saying, we've got this new project. We've got these four girls that we're putting together as a group who would become All Angels. And we want to make a recording, but we've realised that we don't actually have a musical director. And my name had been suggested by somebody else. And so they persuaded me, and I didn't need a lot of persuading, but it was a whole new area at the time that I didn't know much about. And this was an arrangement that I did for them. And this was my first foray into recording what we call classical crossover music. And so when I listen to it now, I just think still, and it's with a lovely voice of Laura Wright, who's doing ever so well these days. I just thought, you know, here we go. So this is pretty special to me.
Songbirds keep singing like they know.
All Angels and Songbird from 2006, and originally it was a Fleetwood Mac track from way back in the 70s, I think. Chosen by Simon Lowell, my guest on Folktale. Simon, you left Salisbury in 2005. That must have been a tough decision, because it was your dream job. It's everything you'd ever always wanted to achieve.
Yeah, it was, but then, you know, it just felt like, I've done that now. I've done my dream job. I've done it for a good number of years, been successful at it. We've toured the world. And it's pretty tough doing services every single day, running two choirs. And it was quite exhausting. And I just thought, no, I want to do other things and see what else comes out. I want to do more media stuff. And so we moved up north and I started my work with the BBC, well, more work with the BBC in the religious department. And as we just heard, All Angels, that opened a whole new door for me. I arranged all the tracks for that, and then we did three albums. And then I started working with people like Hayley Westenra, Camilla Kerslake, and then Aled. I knew Aled from a long time before, but I started doing all Aled's music for him. And so it went on, and now I arrange music for CDs and recordings for all sorts of artists and play for them and direct music sessions for them. So that's something I really love, and the arranging. And after All Angels, I had another group called Celeste, and we had a great album with them as well. So it's all been a lot of fun, and you know, and these days I just do a lot of freelance work. I live down here on a farm near Sherborne. Play the organ, my little bit of organ playing now, play the organ down in Swanage, although I do play a lot for the BBC for various things. And Songs of Praise is very dear to my heart. You know, I've watched it all those years, and I do a lot of the outside broadcasts, the music broadcasts, so I conduct. And that's not just about the musical side of leading the people. It's actually about inspiring the people again and telling corny jokes and keeping people happy for 3 hours, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all fun, and I play the organ for them as well. So, you know, I lead a very varied life, and I feel very fortunate that, you know, I've achieved all the things I really wanted to achieve, but there are still more things to achieve, and people have been good to me, and I, you know, I keep my door open and hope new things will come along all the time.
And would you say you're equally happy, as happy in the world of popular music as you were in the steeped traditions of the church?
Yeah. I mean, the church music is what I grew up on and what I suppose is my forte. But once a musician, always a musician, and I'm that sort of person. I think I've been given the type of gregarious character, which means that I can adapt. And I see it like that. You know, I think, you know, last year I achieved an ambition of conducting Elgar Dream of Gerontius in the Lighthouse, something I've always wanted to do. But then the year before, I was conducting some rock and roll. And, you know, for me, if you can conduct Elgar or Mozart, you can conduct rock and roll. And, you know, so I'll go with whatever. I'm one of those people that will say yes and then think, oh, God, what have I done? How am I going to do this? But then there's always a way. And it's great.
And currently we can hear you accompanying the daily service from time to time on
You can, Radio 4. Yeah, accompanying, yeah, or directing the choir, and yeah, all or sorts of things. Or you see me wave my arms on Songs of Praise regularly. Yes. Yeah, all sorts of different things.
So. And what comes next? Have you got any further ambitions?
Any further ambitions? Well, not really. I mean, just to do more of the same thing. As I say, I do a lot of choir work still. I love working with choirs. I'm off to New Mexico in a few weeks' time to premiere a big piece that I've written for them. I do a lot of writing, composing still. And then I'm off to South Africa to run a summer school out there with a couple of hundred people. So I do lots of that, traveling around. But, you know, what's so exciting about freelance work is that, you know, the phone can suddenly... Oh, I've done a TV show as well about church music for an American TV company. We've got another series coming up of that. So, but then, you know, the phone sometimes just rings and somebody says, can you do this? And it's something really quirky or something really crazy. And I think, well, yeah, you know, I've played the piano in the Chelsea Flower Show in the middle of a great bunch of rhododendrons. I've done all sorts of things and I'm up for that. So I hope there's lots more of that.
What's your final piece? This is Bad Company and Can't Get Enough.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this is the last thing you'd expect from me, really. But when I was a student, not only was I a serious church musician, but I was also a secret rocker. And I used to go to the Hammersmith Odeon and various places and see all those wonderful rock bands of the 70s. And Paul Rodgers, who is the vocalist with Free and their Bad Company, was my favourite, still is my favourite rock vocalist. Of course, he went on to work with Queen after Freddie Mercury's demise. And the first album, A Bad Company, was just spectacular for me. I just loved it. And the title track, which was a hit, I think, a hit single, Can't Get Enough. Still to this day, when you hear the count in and the drums come in, kicking in at the beginning, still as good as it gets.
Well, probably their biggest hit. It's Bad Company and Can't Get Enough. Simon Lowell, thank you very much for coming in and being our guest on Folk Tales today.
My pleasure, Terry.